It's 5:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Gene Purcell, in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the state legislature is wrapping up for the year. We'll hear about the top items they passed and what they left on the table for the next session.
First, though, a look at the 27 Club. A lot of major rock stars, from Jim Morrison to Amy Winehouse, died at the age of 27. Our next guest set out to tell some of their stories.
Howard Soons joins us now. He's a biographer. His new book is 27, A History of the 27 Club, through the lives of Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, and Amy Winehouse. Howard, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So before we get into some of the individual stories, what are some of the common themes, the things you kept running up against as you looked into the lives of these artists who died at age 27?
Yes, well, I wanted to see if there was anything beyond a coincidence of so many famous people dying at the same age. And what I found was that they had many common factors in their lives, starting with troubled childhoods, which was a rocky beginning in life, and the problems start there and build, which explains their early demise.
And then there's that almost a stereotype or cliche of the hard-living, drug- and alcohol-fueled rock and roll lifestyle. Is that something also that in all six of these cases came up?
Yeah, but these aren't people who are drinking and taking drugs to have a good time. They're taking drink and drugs because they're basically desperately unhappy and psychologically flawed, people with on the border of mental illness, some more than others. But with Amy Winehouse, for instance, Janis Joplin as well, these are people with really deep psychological problems. And so they drank and they took drugs to get away from themselves, escape their problems, escape themselves. And this led to a sort of downward path of self-destruction. That's part of the story.
And then all of themselves found them in a scene where, A, they had the money for alcohol and drugs, but also they had ready access to anything they could get their hands on.
Yeah, well, of course, singers work in an environment, especially when they start their careers, when they're young, before they make it. They start in bars, and that's where you buy booze and where you buy drugs. But, of course, the money side of it doesn't really make any difference. You don't need a lot of money to buy a bottle of booze or to buy some heroin. The problems are really deep-rooted and start before they're famous, before anyone knows who they are, before they're millionaires. It starts when they're kids, they're unhappy kids, they become troubled adolescents, they start abusing drink and drugs as part of that troubled adolescence, and then they become suddenly overwhelmingly famous overnight and don't cope well with it. They're not people who are psychologically strong in the first place, and they don't cope well with success.
Is that the difference between the people you write about in this book and the many, many rock stars who, you know, we know about their drug days and their hard lifestyles, but they're still with us? When they went into it, they were at this psychological disadvantage in a way.
I think so. I mean, a very good example of that is Mick Jagger and Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones. And many people will forget that, in fact, the Rolling Stones was founded by Brian Jones, the guy with the yellow hair who played the guitar in the band before Ronnie Wood joined the band. So it was Brian's band, but Brian was a neurotic, unhappy, mixed-up guy and destroyed himself and then died this ridiculous sort of accidental death when he went swimming in the middle of the night when he was drunk, when he'd been taking pills. Now, he wasn't a strong guy psychologically. He wasn't cut out for fame, as Mick Jagger has observed. But Mick and Keith, despite all the debauchery, the high living, the hedonism, they are strong characters, and they've coped well, and they've enjoyed their fame. They've enjoyed being famous. But it was all a bit too much for Brian, and it was certainly too much for Amy and Janis and many of the others.
Well, let's follow with Brian Jones, and we'll give a listen to Paint It Black. I think it's Brian Jones playing sitar here.
Yeah.
No more will my green seagull turn a deeper blue. I could not foresee this thing happening to you.
So, Brian Jones, talented guitarist, multi-instrumentalist, you tell the story. He he wasn't happy with the direction the Rolling Stones went in. He wanted to be a blues cover band.
Well, yes, he was a blues purist. He was a white middle-class boy from Cheltenham in the west of England, from a very middle-class family. But he had that fascination with black working-class music, you know, a world away, music that he didn't know firsthand, but he knew through records. And he was a purist, and he wasn't a great songwriter. And so when the Stones took off in a different direction with Mick and Keith writing pop hits, he didn't really approve of that. He thought that was a bit beneath him. And, of course, there were frictions in the band, and he just didn't get along with the other guys, and that was part of his problems. Each of the six main stars in the book have slightly different stories, but you see a general similarity between the lives if you look at them in the whole.
Well, and his death, you said it was, people have described it as an accidental death, but it seems like, again, a common theme in the stories you tell is that these are people who are very much flirting with self-destruction, whether they're overtly trying to commit suicide, they're very much dancing on the brink of it.
Yeah, and many of them attempt suicide. I mean, Brian attempted suicide long before he actually died. And by his very behavior, by his abuse of drink and drugs, he was flirting with death. And he was hospitalized. There were many close shaves, and he often threatened suicide and attempted suicide. So the final death, although it is accidental, the way he drowned, you know, it's not a sensible thing to do, to go swimming in the middle of the night when you've been drinking and taking drugs. It's not a sensible thing to do. It's a reckless thing to do, and it's the sort of stupid thing that he would have done that might well have ended fatally. And look at Jimi Hendrix, the next of the big six. Well, he also died accidentally by taking too many sleeping tablets, but he took 9 pills when half a pill would have been enough to put him to sleep for the night, on top of drinking. Well, this is reckless behavior, you know, beyond what is reasonable.
Let's give a little listen to Jimi Hendrix now, Purple Haze. So I picked a clip featuring his singing there. Probably should have picked something featuring his guitar playing more so. But did he start in the same way that Brian Jones and the others did, a rocky lifestyle from the word go?
Well, an unhappy childhood. His father wasn't a very nice guy, and his parents, you know, it wasn't a stable relationship. The parents broke up. They were very, very poor, so he has this difficult childhood. And often, you know, the parents of the 27s are part of the problem. And Jimi Hendrix's dad didn't approve of him trying to become a musician and wasn't at all helpful or supportive. And so Jimmy, you know, joined the army to get away from dad. So that was part of the story of his early life. Often you'll find the 27s are in conflict with their parents, or the parents divorce when they're at an impressionable age, which was true of Jimmy and Amy and Kurt Cobain. And this destabilizes them, you know, as kids.
I want to visit one more before we take a break. We won't stick with chronology here. Let's check out Amy Winehouse in Rehab.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no, no, no.
So really just tragic there. I mean, she's openly acknowledging this conflict over drugs and alcohol that ultimately killed her. Talk about, you spend a fair amount of time coming back to that song through the book. Talk about that and where she was.
Well, she got into heroin and crack cocaine, which was obviously a great problem. And her family tried to get her to go to rehab, as she sings in the song. She's singing about her own life. It's directly autobiographical. But she wasn't somebody who wanted to submit to therapy. And so she never really engaged with therapy or psychologists or people who wanted to help her with her problems. She did eventually quit drugs, but she did so only by turning to alcohol. and she drank herself to death. I mean, I think many people forget this, that when she died, there were the police found three empty bottles of vodka in her bedroom, and she died alone, having been drinking alone, and drank herself to death. And doctors warned her, you know, that this wasn't a surprise. She was told in terms by her doctor the day before she died, if you continue to drink like this, Amy, you will die. And she'd been hospitalized for excessive drinking, as she had for her drug problem. And this is a long story, a long unhappy story that goes back a long, long way before she was famous. A story of sort of self-hatred, really, and misery, which she expresses so beautifully in her songs. I mean, she was a great songwriter, I think, and a wonderful singer, a really original talent, but a desperately unhappy person, and that's part of the music.
We're talking to Howard Soons about his new book, 27. It's about rock legends who died at age 27.
And you can join in the discussion, too. What are your thoughts on the so-called 27 Club? How might the music of these artists or their stories have changed if they would have lived longer? If you're a music fan, give us a call at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. And you can also post comments on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
We pick up our conversation now with Howard Soons, author of 27. It's a book that looks at the lives of Janis Joplin, Kurt Cobain, and other rock legends who died at age 27. Give a listen to another one now, The Doors and Jim Morrison.
Please believe me, if you don't need me, I'm going, but I need I would drown myself in mystic heated wine.
So, Howard, Jim Morrison talking about drowning himself in mystic heated wine, one of my favorite Doors songs there, actually. But he had thought about, I think, suicide, you mentioned in your book.
Yeah, a lot of these people talk about suicide. And the interesting thing about Jim Morrison is that he was an intellectual, and he read philosophy, and he kind of intellectualized his own life, and that was what the Doors were all about, really. And so in his last days in Paris, and of course his life ends in Paris in 1971, fascinating story, really, of his last days in France. He's talking about Nietzsche and what Nietzsche wrote about suicide, and Nietzsche can be interpreted as a sort of an advocate of suicide, even. There is this element, this sort of suicidal element to his behavior. We don't really know whether it was an accident when he overdosed in the Paris apartment or whether he meant to overdose, but the end result was the same. And like the others, he'd been going downhill for a long time.
So in reading your book, and I imagine in writing it, the big sense I get, in a selfish sense, is a sense of loss. Like, how much more great music did these people have in them that the world never got to hear?
Well, we'll never know that, of course. I think some of them had really dried up already. Amy hadn't created any new music of any note for several years and seemed to feel trapped by her image. And I think that was true of Jim Morrison. I think he'd outgrown this image as the Lizard King, this boy in leather pants, singing this rather pretentious music, much of it, I think. Perhaps Jimi Hendrix was the most talented of all of them, the most naturally gifted. And one can imagine Jimi Hendrix, he was talking about getting into jazz and playing with Miles Davis before he died. And he seemed to have more legs than the others. I can see him having a long career. But it seemed to me that many of the others had enough. And they were weary of life, and they were weary of this career that they'd built and they'd become trapped in. And you can't imagine, can you, Kurt Cobain singing Smells Like Teen Spirit at age 50, and I can't imagine Janis Joplin at 70 bawling her lungs out, and I can't imagine Jim Morrison doing the Doors.
I want to argue with you. Johnny Cash, we just talked about him, and he had a period of drugs and self-destructiveness and came back in the 90s with some of the most powerful music he ever did. I mean, I would love to have had these guys have a chance to do that, even if they weren't just retreading their hits for years.
Yeah, but I think the difference is that many of these people, that their careers had already come to a halt, and they felt trapped. They didn't like what they were doing. They didn't like the persona that they created. They hated who they had become. And I think that that's a different situation. I mean, Amy Winehouse, for instance, she sang about her own misery, and particularly the misery of a relationship with her first husband, with her husband. That was the substance of that great album she made, Back to Black. Well, she got to the stage where she just didn't want to sing those songs anymore because it made her so unhappy, but she didn't have any new songs, and she didn't really know what she wanted to do. She really wanted to get married and have a family, but that option just didn't seem to, that didn't happen for her. So it seems to me that her career had stopped, you know.
All right, let's go to the phones. We've got Don in Milwaukee with us. Don, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Great topic. Can't wait to read the book. But do you think it's just part of, like, like a self-indulgent kind of egotism of youth that, you know, drives these people to not see beyond maybe what they've accomplished or never accept themselves? And so the substance abuse problems, you know, you drown yourself in alcohol, and, you know, Jim Morrison had a lot of songs about that, and Janis Joplin's notorious history with alcohol, and Amy Winehouse, that kind of played out, I think, in public for many years. Is that just kind of a self-indulgent egotism that just comes with being young and famous and very talented, and you get trapped by it?
Gotcha. Thanks, Don. What do you think, Howard?
I think some of that is true. These are self-indulgent people, and of course they are spoiled. But I think more importantly, they're very unhappy people. They're people who are basically unhappy. So as I said at the beginning, they're not getting hired for fun most of the time, although some of the time that was true. Towards the end, they're getting hired because they're so deep down miserable. And you have to follow the trajectory of their lives, their short lives, to see that that's true, really. They've got really deep problems.
I wonder about the people around the 27 Club. Do you get a sense that there were a lot of people enabling this, overlooking the risk, the conflicts within these people?
Absolutely. The people around them are half the problem. And the reason why, one of the things we haven't mentioned is the reason that all these ridiculous conspiracy theories have grown up around these stars, these kind of mysteries about how they died exactly. Part of the reason for that is that the people these stars were with at the end, notably Jim Morrison and Jimi Hendrix, the women they were with, were frankly completely dishonest. They were also drug users, and they concocted stories about the last hours of these men in order to evade questions about what they were up to. And this has created mystery where mystery doesn't need to exist. And often the families of these people were not particularly helpful. The stars didn't like their families. And yet the great irony, the great cosmic irony of it, is that when they die, the families become stupendously rich, which is something I detail in the last chapter of the book. The money that has accrued to the estates of these people after death is absolutely phenomenal, whereas most of them actually didn't make that much money in life.
We only have about a minute left. Do you get a sense in reading and writing about these musicians that there was a step in their lives where something could have gone different and they wouldn't have died young?
Well, yes. I think the thing they wished for, the thing that so many young people wish for, which is fame, and more so than ever these days, young people crave fame. They think that fame will somehow fill them up and make their lives worthwhile. What they don't realize is that unless they are basically already in a good place in life, fame is not going to solve their problems. It's going to bring in a lot more problems. And in fact, it can destroy you. And I think these people were, to some extent, destroyed by their success. If they hadn't have become so successful, maybe they could have worked out their lives in anonymity. But they were destroyed by the very thing that they achieved. But in that self-destruction, of course, I must say, they created some timeless music. All of them did. They were all remarkably talented artists, and that's what we get from them. But they paid the price with their lives.
Howard, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Howard Soons. His new book is 27, A History of the 27 Club Through the Lives of Brian Jones, Jimi Hendrix, Janis Joplin, Jim Morrison, Kurt Cobain, and Amy Winehouse. As we go out, we'll listen to some Nirvana and Kurt Cobain.
And coming up, a look at what the state legislature passed and left on the table in the session that is just about to end. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Farah. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.
We're talking to a Capitol reporter about what's going on in Wisconsin state government.
Yesterday was the last scheduled day of the session for the state Senate for this year, and the state assembly will wrap up its fall 2013 session tomorrow. Here to fill us in on what was passed and what's still left on the table is Patrick Marley. He's a Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, co-author of More Than They Bargained For with fellow Journal Sentinel reporter Jason Stein. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, Rob.
Well, let's start with this one. Yesterday, the Senate passed a proposed constitutional amendment that would allow members of the state Supreme Court to elect their own Chief Justice. What's next for this bill?
Well, this will now go to the Assembly on Thursday, and we'll have we're expected to have a very long debate on Thursday. A lot of controversial issues are up. If that passes as expected, it would then have to come back up in 2015 because it's a constitutional amendment. If the legislature passed it in both houses then, it would go to voters. They would decide whether to change the Constitution. Currently, the job of Chief Justice goes to the most senior member of the court, and for the last 17-some years, that's been Shirley Abrahamson. A lot of conflict on our court, a lot of disagreements. She is often in the minority on opinions, and I think there's a sense among conservatives that they would like the justices to be able to choose from their own ranks for who should be Chief Justice.
And critics have said this is just going to add more politics to the court, they make the case.
Right. The critics say that this is sour grapes, that we've had this in our Constitution for well over 100 years, and that it's a system that works. We shouldn't have this kind of rancor to add to what the discord we already have.
And before we break into more particular issues, you mentioned a lot on the plate tomorrow at the state assembly, including some controversial issues. Seems like the Senate decided to hold off on a lot of the most controversial stuff as the session came to the end. The assembly, not so much?
Yeah, that's right. Just prior to the last session day, it looked like the Senate could be taking on a lot of controversial issues, including some abortion measures, but they backed off on much of their agenda. The assembly is going to start at 1 o'clock on Thursday. Looks like they could go until 2 a.m. as they debate things like voter ID, limiting voting hours, the Chief Justice bill, a bill restricting access to the mine site in northern Wisconsin.
And that voter ID bill, there's a current existing voter ID bill hung up in the courts. What's the difference on this new one?
Right. So we have there was a voter ID law was put in place in 2011. There were four lawsuits filed. In two of those cases, judges blocked the law. One of those was overturned on appeal, but the initial judge's ruling blocking it remains in place. So the law really hasn't been used. There's a federal trial in Milwaukee on the law as well. And so this bill would soften the requirement somewhat so that people who had a religious objection to being photographed or who couldn't afford to get the documents to get an ID would be able to vote without an ID if they signed an affidavit. And the supporters of voter ID believe that if they can put that in place, it weakens the legal challenges to the law that have said that the voting ID requirement is so strict that it disenfranchises people.
But Senate Republican leaders at some points were kind of balking at this. I got the sense they're saying, hey, let's wait and see if the one we already passed gets through the courts before we start nerfing what we already have.
That's exactly right. We have Republicans control both houses, but there's a disagreement on this issue. The Assembly is moving full speed ahead to get this done because they say, Speaker Robin Voss in particular has said, he wants to do everything he can to make sure that a voter ID requirement is in place for the 2014 election for governor. His corollary in the Senate, the Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, has said, no, this is in the middle of these legal challenges. Let's see what the courts actually say in all the cases, and then we can, you know, his belief and his hope is that it will be upheld by the courts. If it is not, then they'll have very specific guidelines as to what's constitutional and what's not, and they can craft a new version of the law to meet the court requirements.
So one thing that's been going on doesn't seem to have the partisan controversy around it. The Assembly passed a bunch of mental health-related bills. This has been a long time in the making, right?
Yeah, they've been working on this all year, and this has been sort of this bright point of bipartisanship. Every bill, they've passed 13 bills dealing with mental health. On Tuesday, all of them were either unanimous or on a voice vote where no dissent was registered. And so it's going to be quite a contrast between Tuesday when you have everybody working together on issues and tomorrow when they're going to be bitterly divided.
What kind of things are in those mental health bills? Briefly, I know you mentioned there's over 10.
There's a lot of them, but, you know, taken together, it's about $4 million more spent on mental health for things like mobile intervention crisis teams. Peer respite centers. So these are respite centers that are run by people who have had mental health issues in the past, and people say that for like veterans in particular, it's very effective to be able to talk to people who have gone through the same sorts of things. And there's people in Medicaid programs that would be able to get services more quickly in their homes. Many issues like that.
And there was kind of a general recognition from both parties that some of Wisconsin's mental health system are out of date. We need to catch up here. Is that what brought that bipartisanship together?
Yeah. I mean, there's, you know, I think that there have been a lot of problems in Milwaukee County, but really these are issues that face every county. There's a lot of county-run systems, and, you know, these laws were put in place in the 1970s. A lot of people feel like the science has advanced a lot. Treatment philosophies have changed quite a bit since then, and they needed to get with the time, so to speak.
All right, ping-ponging back to something more controversial. You mentioned abortion legislation coming up in the Assembly tomorrow. This is stuff that didn't pass the Senate, that they wouldn't, even if the Assembly passes it, they wouldn't hit till January, if at all, right?
Right. The one issue on abortion that the Assembly is to take up tomorrow would be to create a license plate that says Choose Life on it, and then it would funnel money to a group that would run what they call pregnancy crisis centers. So it's a place that a pregnant person could go and get information, but these are run by people who oppose abortion so that they would be counseling them not to seek abortions.
And objections from people worried about that very thing, that would be using state money, in effect, for a particular point of view on this? Is that the hurdle?
The opponents of it, they feel like it's a state sponsorship of a position opposite of theirs. But what they are more critical of is that they say these centers can pressure women, can give them false information, and that they don't trust that these things would be objective.
I say this so often on this show, it could be a catchphrase. This sounds like the sort of thing that could end up in court if it passes.
I haven't heard if that is something that could be litigated, but obviously the last abortion law that they passed, which actually restricted the practice of abortion or required admitting privileges for doctors who performed abortions, that went to court and was quickly blocked by a federal judge. The case is going to go on for some months or years, but it was immediately struck down.
So looking ahead to January, as a Capitol reporter, what stories are you thinking are going to be the big deal come January?
Well, I think a lot of what the Assembly does here, you know, is they're going to move over to the Senate, and we're going to have to see, there are two other bills on abortion that have already passed the Assembly. a great question is, you know, what is the Senate going to take those up? All of these election restrictions, are they going to is the Senate going to take those up? Another bill that the Assembly passed earlier this year would double the amount that donors can give to candidates for governor and other state offices, and also that would allow people to register to vote online. That was a bipartisan bill where Republicans were able to get a lot of Democratic votes by including the online voter registration. It's being met with pretty deep skepticism among the Senate Republicans. So the question is if that'll pass. Another bill, a lot of things have passed the Assembly and not been taken up by the Senate so far. One would raise the speed limit to 70 miles an hour from the current 65 on interstates.
All right, lot to look forward to in the next session. Patrick, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
That was Patrick Marley. He's a Capitol reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, co-author of More Than They Bargained For with his fellow reporter Jason Stein.
I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Asthma is the most common chronic disease in the United States, but it can be easily controlled with medications such as inhalers or daily pills.
But often these medications are expensive, even though they're much cheaper in other developed countries like the United Kingdom.
So why are these drugs, these devices, so expensive in the U.S.? Here to help us answer that question today is Gerard Anderson. He is a professor of health policy and management and of international health at the Johns Hopkins University Bloomberg School of Public Health. He's also a professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine and director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Hospital Finance and Management. Gerard Anderson, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
I want to start out with kind of a general question because, you know, these days so often we hear that we live in a global marketplace where, you know, the products that we buy here in America are influenced by where they're manufactured and what the price might be somewhere else and so forth. But with prescription medication, it seems like we've got these islands where it costs one price in the United States, something else in the UK, and something else somewhere else. Why is that?
Well, because basically other countries negotiate as a country for prices, and we're really talking primarily right now about brand name drugs, not the generic drugs, not the so with those we're paying about twice as much in the United States as compared to other countries because they buy them as one country, and we have Medicare doing it and Medicaid doing it and United Healthcare doing it and everybody doing it, and having so many people buying drugs means that we just end up paying about twice as much as what everybody else is paying.
And so can you give me an example? And it, this carries over, too, as I understand it. You mentioned brand names a few seconds ago, but generics aren't always necessarily that much cheaper.
Well, they're not necessarily cheaper than the brands, but they are tend to be cheaper in the United States generally than they are in other countries. So we actually do pretty well in getting reasonably good generic drug prices. We just do terribly at getting brand name drug prices. There are obviously examples of drugs where we pay more for generics and examples where we pay less. But on average, we do pretty well with generics.
And in terms of a total cost to, say, American health consumers, what are we talking about here in terms of money? Are we talking millions? Are we talking billions of dollars?
Well, we're talking billions of dollars, but I think a better way of looking at it is how much does it cost each an individual person, and that's about $1,000 for drugs for an average person in America. And if we look in other industrialized countries, it's more like $500 a person.
So is this a trend that has been going on for 10 years, 20 years, or is this something that we've seen develop relatively recently?
We've seen this since we started collecting data in the 1960s. We just pay higher prices for pharmaceuticals. We always have, and unfortunately, we might always continue to do that until we really go like other countries do and either buy in bulk, everybody buys it through the government or through some single source, or we find some other way to bring down health care prices and specifically drug prices.
Well, it is hard for you to say that without me saying something about the Affordable Care Act here right now. Is there anything in the Affordable Care Act, in Obamacare, that helps address this situation, or are we talking two different things?
Well, to some extent, we're talking two different things, but there is something in the Affordable Care Act that really does help the seniors, although it doesn't necessarily bring down the prices. So as part of the former bill that passed in 2003 that provided prescription drug coverage for the Medicare beneficiary, there was something called a donut hole, a gap in coverage. And the Affordable Care Act fills in that gap in coverage. So the Medicare beneficiary will not feel the price as much as they did before, but it won't necessarily bring down the prices in the United States for prescription drugs.
Now, and as soon as you mentioned the donut hole, I remember right after that donut hole was created back in 2003, 2004, you know, an endless series of stories on the donut hole and what it was and who was going to be affected and how you could avoid it and the insurance and all those sorts of things. But since then, it doesn't seem as though, even though we're talking about some pretty significant costs to consumers and some pretty significant amounts of money being made, this doesn't seem to be an issue that's always on the front burner. It seems like as though it comes and goes as donut holes appear and disappear.
Right, and it has. And the people that hit the donut hole just sort of accept that they're going to hit the donut hole and was part of the system. But they heard enough about the donut hole to make it an important part of the Affordable Care Act. So that was the negotiation that the Obama administration and the Congress had with the prescription drug industry to fill in that donut hole. So the contribution that the prescription drug industry gave towards the Affordable Care Act was to fill in this donut hole.
So earlier in the interview, you said that the only way we're going to make significant progress in lowering prices is to bargain, to look for deals as a country. How does that process occur? Because it seems as though we're so sort of fragmented right now to bring all those pieces together into a single policy, particularly in the wake of the debate over Obamacare, seems like an awfully tall order.
It is. Well, one of the things that was the big debate as part of the Affordable Care Act and before was at least in the Medicare program, which represents 40% of all prescription drug spending in the United States, if they could negotiate as one entity as opposed to all the different health plans that are part of the Medicare program. If the Medicare program could negotiate as one entity, it would have much more bargaining power than all the individual entities have. So we might not be able to get everybody into it, but we could get the Medicare program. And then, since a public program, we could get the state Medicaid programs into the program. So now you've got over 50-60% of the expenditures in the United States for drugs in Medicare and Medicaid. And if they were a big bulk purchaser, that would be huge. And then it would be up to the private insurers to say, well, if Medicare is paying this, I should be able to pay this, and they might be able to tag along.
Now, as I understand it, though, Medicaid or Medicare is forbidden from negotiating drug prices.
It is.
So what's
that was part of the deal in 2003 for the prescription drug bill. But, you know, those laws get passed, and the laws can get amended. So one of the things that's possible that would actually probably bring down expenditures quite substantially in the United States, and the Congressional Budget Office has shown this, is to have strict negotiations by the Medicare program as a whole.
I mean, there was a story in Time magazine in the past year or so about how hospitals overcharge for medicine because it can be masked within a bill that insurance might wind up paying for. Is that a secondary concern in your mind, or is that a real issue?
Oh, it's a definite issue. I was actually part of that Stephen Brill article and had the last line, which said its price is stupid in that article. Essentially, it's a huge problem. If you go to a hospital in the United States, you're not going to know how much you're going to have to pay. You're going to find out how much you have to pay 2, 3, 4 weeks later. There's no other industry that, at least that I know of, where you find out how much it's going to cost you 2, 3 weeks after you've paid the bill. And while you're getting the services, you don't know how much anything is going to cost. And what's even more strange is that typically you're not the person making the decision anyway. It's your doctor is deciding what drugs you get, how long you remain in the hospital. So you're pretty much powerless to make any informed decision as a consumer in the hospital.
And we've only got about 30 seconds or so, but given all of those ands that you just talked about, given Obamacare, given everything, is it likely that we're going to see any significant action on this anytime soon?
No, I don't think we're going to see any political action. I mean, the Congress is just tied up totally. So I hope we do in the longer run, but I wouldn't look for it in the next 2 or 3 years.
Well, thanks for the update. We appreciate your taking the time to be with us, Gerard.
Thank you. I'm glad to do it.
That was health policy expert Gerard Anderson joining us to talk about the price of prescription medications and what the future looks like in terms of doing something about those prices. He is a health policy expert with Johns Hopkins University.